Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm feeling fighty. This is the first show since Donald Trump's Electoral College victory last week, and we're going to do something a little different this week. For the first time in the 6 years we've been doing the show, we're not going to have any guests. No guests this week. I've had a week and a half to process this catastrophe, and I just want to talk it through with you folks. So that's what we're going to do. We'll play a few songs that capture some of my feelings at this pivotal moment in history. I think they probably capture some of yours as well. I've moved from grief to anger. The sense of shock remains. I thought that Americans were on a whole better than this. And I also have a nagging feeling of impending doom. Again, feeling fighty, but I dread the coming years. And I'm a white guy. I spoke to an acquaintance this week who was despondent. She said, you know, I'm a Muslim, I'm Iranian, and I worry they're going to deport me. And I said, do you have a green card? She said, I'm a U.S. citizen. I mean, they can't just deport her. We still have a functioning judiciary. But this is the kind of fear that Trump's election has created among immigrant communities and communities of color. Meanwhile, we've seen a spate of hate crimes unlike anything we've seen since the period following 9/11. You know, Trumpers, they won. It's amazing how angry they are. It would be frightening to consider how much violence we might be seeing if he had lost. And Trump half-heartedly told his supporters to kind of cut it out, but really half-heartedly. And I think it's really a stark contrast to the post 9/11 period when George W. Bush, to his credit, visited a mosque in Washington, D.C., and told the public that Islam is a religion of peace. And he said this repeatedly and emphatically. And it was one of the few decent things he did. I'm, of course, no George W. Bush fan. So how did this happen? It wasn't a low turnout election, but Clinton underperformed Obama's 2012 results by just a little bit, pretty much across the board. And I think Trump turned out just enough Republicans in crucial swing states to take the Electoral College. Clinton, by the way, will probably end up winning 2 million more votes when they're all counted. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. One of the most annoying things that I've seen the past week and a half is a desire by Democrats and liberals and leftists to relitigate the Democratic primaries. You know, we have a white ethno-nationalist regime that has taken control over the federal government. It'll probably have total control for 4 years. And here we are fighting among ourselves about whether or not Bernie Sanders would have won. And the answer is, I don't know, and neither do you. And you may think you know, but you don't. In general, of course, it's always pointless to argue over a counterfactual. But this one is especially pointless because of what we do know. You know, what we know is that, and this is the only thing we know that Bernie Sanders never faced a billion-dollar general election campaign against the Republican Party in the era of Citizens United, where outside groups can communicate in ways that are far more vicious than a campaign can itself. Far more vicious, far more irresponsible. We don't know what that campaign would have looked like, but we do know that it would have been ugly. And also, fake news played a big role in this election. BuzzFeed reported this week that fake stories got more engagement on Facebook than real stories in the final, I think it was month and a half of the election, and a lot more, like twice as much. And, you know, we can only imagine what kind of crazy stuff they would have made up about Bernie Sanders. We don't know it, but we can imagine it. You know, he would have been a baby eater or something like that. Would the hackers who busted into the Clinton campaign and dribbled out their internal emails have done the same with Sanders? We don't know. They certainly, you know, we don't know if they wanted Trump to win or wanted Clinton to lose or a combination of the two. But you know, I supported Sanders in the primaries because I thought both candidates could win, but I underestimated Trump. I thought he was a two-bit con artist that Americans would see through, and he turned out to be an extraordinarily gifted grifter who sold enough Americans on a bill of goods to get over the top. Now, maybe Sanders would have appealed to some of those anti-establishment Trump voters. It's possible. Maybe he would have lost others. Maybe Michael Bloomberg would have gotten into the race, won a few states, and the House of Representatives would have voted Trump into office. We don't know. It's a pointless discussion. And there's another annoyingly tribal liberal argument. Both sides of this one are totally wrong. The evidence is clear, I think. For me, it's very clear that Hillary Clinton would be president if not for FBI Director James Comey's intervention in the race. And it's equally clear that she was a flawed candidate and that her campaign made serious mistakes. Both of these things seem obviously true to me, but I'm seeing a lot of Clinton supporters saying that she didn't do anything wrong. And a lot of people who supported Sanders are calling Comey's email Gazigate nonsense an excuse. They say it's just an excuse. So, you know, here are two undeniable realities, just factual realities. First, Hillary Clinton's unfavorables were underwater on the day that she announced her candidacy. The primaries did drive her numbers down, but she was already in negative territory. And her vaunted data team, which reportedly guided the campaign's every move, apparently thought Wisconsin was in the bag. She didn't visit the state after April. She lost it by under 30,000 votes. I don't know how you can say that she wasn't a flawed candidate or that she ran a perfect campaign. At the same time, whatever Clinton's flaws were during the final week of the campaign were the same as they were for the first 18 months or whatever. It felt like the election went on for 5 or 6 years. She didn't do anything to sabotage herself in the final week. But, and this is again just a fact, those who decided in the final week after Comey's letter to Congress, this was 13% of the electorate, broke overwhelmingly for Trump in the key swing states. There's no denying that. And there was this consistent pattern throughout the campaign. We had two unpopular candidates, and the polling, and this again happened throughout the campaign, the polling shifted against the one who is getting the most news coverage at any given time. So when we were hearing a lot about Donald Trump, the poll shifted toward Clinton. And when we were hearing a lot about Hillary Clinton, the poll shifted towards Trump. And the last week and a half of this campaign was dominated by almost nonstop coverage of Hillary Clinton's 10-year-old private email server. And that was the ball game. That was it. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about what happened after we take a quick break with, I don't know, this may be one of the most iconic protest songs ever written. Here's Buffalo Springfield from 1967. We'll be right back.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. A field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Welcome back to the show. This is Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. We're doing a special show where we're just kind of processing what happened a week and a half ago with Donald Trump's election. I want to really make this clear. I don't think that Donald Trump is a legitimate president. I believe this was basically a white nationalist coup. And hear me out here. Remember after the 2012 election, the Republican Party released that autopsy report, right? They said, well, the country is changing. It's becoming less white. It's becoming less Christian. The population is becoming more tolerant towards gays and lesbians. And the party had to adapt to this new reality, to this emerging electorate to remain viable, right? Donald Trump's election was like the last gasp of those who flatly and angrily rejected that conclusion, right? The Republican coalition is in decline. We're going to talk next week about some of the demographic shifts that are going on in this country. I have a couple of guests already lined up. And it was only... You know, you have to understand that for years the conservatives have said that they were the kind of the, they represented the silent majority and they were losing their country to immigrants and liberal coastal elites who hated them. And the Republicans promised that they could take back the clock, turn back the clock and like take back the country, right? It was a, they primed the pump for Trump's promise to make America great again, but the base that that message appealed to is shrinking. So there's a guy named Alan Abramowitz. He's a political scientist at Emory University. And he said that he wrote this in 2008. He identified the most loyal Republicans as married white people who identify as Christian. So not married people, not white people, not people who identify as Christian, but all three. And if you look back to the 50s, white married Christians made up around 80% of the American electorate. But by 2004, that core group of the Republican base had fallen to 40% of voters, and it's continued to decline since then. And it will continue to decline in the future because very few young people fall into that category of married white Christians, fewer than one in five. So you had, again, this last gasp of this coalition, this declining coalition. And Trump's election was only possible because, as I mentioned, the interventions by the FBI, but also how many campaigns could survive unknown hackers like releasing their internal emails for 6 weeks? I think that the media proved itself just completely incapable of enforcing long established norms of American democracy with Donald Trump, right? He had this innate gift of knowing how to dominate the news cycle. We never got his tax returns. Imagine if we had spent as much time covering his refusal to release his tax returns as we did on Hillary Clinton's emails. Now, I want to go back to this idea, this Republican autopsy from 2012. Ryan Leza wrote in The New Yorker a great piece called Where the Republican Suicide Caucus Lives. And he looked at 80 congressional districts. They represent about 12% of the voting population. And he called them the Suicide Caucus because they these 80 representatives pushed the party into basically a strategic course that was at odds with what the party's strategists were saying. So the strategists were saying, well, we have to become more inclusive. We need to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And these 80 representatives made sure that that did not happen. Now, these 80 districts are very white and very Republican. Barack Obama lost to Mitt Romney by an average of 23 points in these districts. And the members of Congress themselves beat their Democratic opponents by an average of 34 points. So these are just deep, deep red districts. And they're insulated from the rest of the country. So you have the party leadership saying, well, we need to modernize. We need to get ourselves together with this new electorate. And then you had these 80 suicide caucus members who, you know, they had a base that was riled up by conservative media, and they had more fear of being challenged by a Tea Party whack job than being beaten in a general election. So they rendered the GOP's autopsy report kind of like a mere footnote to the 2012 election. But that left Republicans at a national level. They've been doing fine at the state level, caught between these demographic headwinds and a base that wouldn't let them adapt. So they had little choice, really. They had to set their sights on democracy, right? They controlled a majority of state governments, and they kept passing these laws to make it harder to vote. Not only voter ID laws. By the way, there was this study. We had a show on this. A comprehensive study of the impact of strict photo ID laws by researchers at the University of California, San Diego. We did a segment on it. They found that strict ID laws depress Democratic turnout by 8.8%. And they depress Republican turnout by 3.6%. So you get a 5-point net reduction in your opponent's votes. And GOP officials always cite voter fraud to justify these laws, although that's not really a thing. And they often admit that their voter suppression is intentional. 14 states had passed new restrictions on voting in time for the 2016 election. They included Michigan and Ohio. And it's not just voter ID laws. They closed early voting locations. There were over 800 fewer polling places in the United States in 2016 than there were in 2012, even though the population has grown. My colleague at The Nation, Ari Berman, he reported that as many as 300,000 people in Wisconsin didn't have the necessary ID to vote. Overwhelmingly, this group skewed towards, you know, Democratic groups, older people, African Americans. And Trump won that state by 27,000. So, and now we don't know the cumulative effect of all of these efforts to suppress the vote, but we know that they had an impact. And this is kind of true of, you know, Republicans always rely on low turnout. They've held on to their congressional majority and won a number of state houses by dominating midterm contests in which around a third of eligible voters participate. And I want to note that if non-voters voted, the GOP would be hard-pressed to win anything outside of the South. Sean McElwee did an analysis of the unregistered voters, so people who are not registered to vote. It's about a quarter of the population, and they lean overwhelmingly Democratic. You could look at the felon disenfranchisement laws too. You know, we have 5% of the world's population and around a quarter of its prisoners. And according to the Sentencing Project, 6 million people in this country are barred from voting by these voter disenfranchisement laws that became popular after the Civil War. And they were a means of making sure that Black people didn't gain political power, and they're still on the books. So you have 6 million people, according to the Sentencing Project. 3 out of 4 of them have served their time. They've paid their debt to society, and now they're taxed without representation. It's a, you know, it's a broken democracy. Now, I think that, you know, Donald Trump, he 2 weeks before the election, Bloomberg Businessweek reported that the Trump campaign had this strategy in the final push to win by suppressing key Democratic groups. They were going to turn off idealistic white liberals, young women, and African Americans. As I said in the opening, in the end, Clinton underperformed Obama among most demographic groups, but we can't give Trump too much credit. His campaign had all this outside help, right? You had the WikiLeaks, James Comey. And here's where I'm going with all of this. In January, Donald Trump will become the second Republican in five cycles to lose the popular vote and win the White House. His party will control 55% of the seats in the House of Representatives, despite winning about 50% of the popular vote. In the current Senate, we don't have all the numbers in yet, right? But in the current Senate, 20 million more Americans voted for the 46 members of the Democratic caucus than for the 54 Republicans who control the chamber. And this year, we do know that Democrats are, Senate Democrats cumulatively are about 6 million votes ahead in the 33 Senate races decided this year, right? So what happens? Trump will appoint a right-wing justice to the Supreme Court. That justice will join a conservative majority with two others appointed by the last president to lose the popular vote. And it was that majority that gutted the Voting Rights Act and allowed these red states to, you know, run wild with all of these voting restrictions. And this is not how democracy is supposed to work. Donald Trump's presidency is illegitimate, right? In a democracy, majority rule is supposed to confer legitimacy on our leaders. And of course, we need to have protection for minorities. But, you know, the person who gets more people to the polls should win. And with a unified government, he'll be able to undo most of the achievements that we fought so hard for under the country's first black president, who was twice elected by really wide margins and is leaving as one of the most popular outgoing presidents in modern history. Now, Paul Ryan is probably going to get his long-held dream of privatizing Medicare and block granting Medicaid, undoing the Affordable Care Act. So Trump is going to unravel a decent chunk of not only the accomplishments of the last few years, but of the social safety net that was established, you know, in the 60s. And that stuff is popular, right? Medicare is very popular. And, you know, this election really has to serve as a wake-up call. All right, we're going to take a quick break. This one was from Eminem. I like this song. It was actually an anthem against George W. Bush. And we'll take a quick break and come right back.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Every word, memorize every line. I spit it once, refuel, re-energize and rewind. I give sight to the blind, mind sight through the mind. I exercise my right to express when I feel it's time. It's just all in your mind, what you interpret it as. I say the fight, you take it as I'ma whip someone's ass. If you don't understand, don't even bother to ask. A father who has grown up with a fatherless past, who has grown up now to rap phenomenon that has morbidly shows no difficulty multitasking and juggling both. Perhaps mastered his craft slash entrepreneur. entrepreneur who has helped launch a few more rap acts, who's had a few obstacles thrown his way through the last half of his career, typical manure moving past that. Mr. Kiss's ass crack, he's a class act. Rubber band man, yeah, he just snaps back. Come along, follow me as I lead through the darkness, as I provide just enough spark that we need to proceed. Carry on, give me hope, give me strength. Come with me and I won't steer you wrong. Put your faith and your trust as I guide us through the fog to the light. At the end of the tunnel, we gon' fight, we gon' charge, we gon' storm, we gon' march through the swamp, we gon' march through the marsh. Take us right through the doors. Come on, people up top, on the side, in the middle, come together, let's all fall and storm just a little. Just let it gradually build from the front to the back. All you can see is the sea of people, some white and some black. No matter what color, all that matters, we're gathered together to celebrate for the same cause. No matter the weather, if it rains, let it rain. Yeah, the wetter the better. They ain't gonna stop us, they can't. We're stronger now more than ever. They tell us no, we say yeah. They tell us stop, we say go. Rebel with a rebel yell. Raise hell, we gon' let them know. Storm, push up, mush up, push until they bring our troops home. Come on, just come along, follow me as I lead through the darkness, as I provide just enough spark that we need to proceed. Carry on, give me hope, give me strength. Come with me and I won't steer you wrong. Put your faith and your trust as I guide us through the fog to the light. At the end of the tunnel, we gon' fight, we gon' charge, we gon' storm, we gon' march through the swamp, we gon' march through the marsh. Take us right through the doors. Come on. Imagine it pouring, swaying down on us. Marsh pits outside the Oval Office. Someone's trying to tell us something. Maybe this is God just saying we're responsible for this monster, this coward that we have empowered. This is Bin Laden. Look at his head nodding. How could we allow something like this without pumping our fists? Now this is our final hour. Let me be the voice and your strength and your choice. Let me simplify the rhyme just to amplify the noise. Try to amplify it times it and multiply it by 16 million people all equal with this high pitch. Maybe we can reach Al-Qaeda through my speech. Let the president answer high anarchy. Strap him with an AK-47, let him go fight his own war. Let him impress daddy that way. No more blood for oil, we got our own battles to fight out our own soil. No more psychological warfare to trick us to thinking that we ain't loyal. If we don't serve our own country, we're patronizing a hero. Look in his eyes, it's all lies. The stars and stripes, they've been swiped, washed out and wiped, and replaced with his own face. Marsh now or die. If I get sniped tonight, you know why, as I told you to fight. So come along, follow me as I lead through the darkness, as I provide just enough spark that we need to proceed. Carry on, give me hope, give me strength. Come with me and I won't steer you wrong. Put your faith and your trust as I guide us through the fog to the light. At the end of the tunnel, we gon' fight, we gon' charge, we gon' storm, we gon' march through the swamp, we gon' march through the marsh. Take us right through the doors. Come on. And as we proceed to march through this desert storm, in these closing statements, if they should all...
Welcome back. This is Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. So I mentioned earlier the spate of Donald Trump-related hate crimes. I can't be the only one who thinks that it's a little unseemly that, as you know, Muslim women are shedding their hijabs to avoid being attacked in the street by goons, and people of color afraid for their physical safety, the political press decided that we have to focus on understanding the pain felt by the white people who elected Donald Trump. I'm talking, of course, about the obsession with the white working class voters in the Rust Belt. Now, here's the thing. It is clear that that this group provided Trump with that razor-thin margin of victory, right? The data show that Trump won a number of Midwestern counties with lots of blue-collar whites that went for Obama in 2012, in some cases by large margins. But this is the important thing. How we interpret that data is important. It's important for how the Democratic Party moves forward, because you're seeing a lot of pieces that are arguing that Trump's win was in large part a result of these non-college educated white voters switching from Obama to the Republicans in 2012, and maybe we've lost them for good. And if that's true, then the logical conclusion is that Democrats have to reach out to this group specifically, or they're going to face the prospect of future losses. And that means not only speaking to their economic anxiety that we've been hearing so much about, but also appealing to their cultural and social grievances, right? It might mean moderating the Democrats' support for gun safety measures. That's an important wedge issue for a lot of these rural white people in those key states that Trump flipped. The last time the party decided to chase blue-collar Reagan Democrats, it ended up in Bill Clinton's push for welfare reform and sister soldier moments, et cetera, et cetera. If, on the other hand, and again, it's important we get this right, Trump energized just enough Republican leaners who stayed home in 2012, and Clinton failed to turn out just enough Democratic partisans, then we can attribute this disaster to factors that have nothing to do specifically with white working class voters, right? And we've talked about some of those reasons. And if that's the case, then the solution, whatever it is, should be the same for blue-collar white Democrats as it is for Latinos or African-Americans, for the entire Democratic coalition. You know, we need to run a better candidate. That candidate should focus more energy on articulating a progressive economic agenda, for instance. And if that's the case, we shouldn't indulge in a lot of hand-wringing over this one group of white people. Now, based on what we know now, and I should say that this is all according to exit polls, which are subject to a certain amount of error. And the big thing that they missed in 2012 were that they didn't count exactly the group we're talking about, white non-college educated people. But according to what we now know, according to the exit polls, Clinton underperformed Barack Obama among not only college-educated whites, but here's a list of other groups that she underperformed Obama with: white men in general, black men and women, Hispanic men and women, Asian men and women of other races, every age group except voters over 65. Liberals, moderates, and conservatives, Protestants, Catholics, others, and people with no religious affiliation. She only did better among Jews. Married men and unmarried men and women, union and non-union households, self-identified Democrats, straight people, people who think undocumented immigrants should be given legal status, people who think the country is going in the right direction, et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, this intense focus on non-college whites is already a bit odd, right? She underperformed Obama among every group, almost every group. Jews, Republicans, and one other, what was it? Married women. That's it. Those are the groups she did better than Obama, or she tied or did better than Obama with. Now, it's absolutely true that in 2016, non-college whites swung to the GOP by a 15-point margin relative to 2012. So a really significant amount. But Clinton underperformed Obama among voters of all races who make less than $30,000 per year by the same margin, right? And if the pundits were like writing thousands of columns about how the Democrats need to win back low-income voters, I think it would have a better influence on Democratic policy. As for whether these were mostly former Obama voters, it's important to understand that we're talking about a group that tends to turn out in low numbers. In 2012, one in four high school grads voted, just one in four. That was true of fewer than 10% of those who didn't complete high school. I think it was 6%. and around 4 in 10 of those with some college experience. So in every one of those counties that flipped from Obama to Trump, it's safe to assume that there was a much larger pool of non-voters combined with Romney supporters to go and vote for Trump than former Obama voters. So Occam's razor would suggest that, you know, some combination of Trump's celebrity and his image as a populist outsider and his appeal to white racial grievances caused enough people who had given up on the system and just not bothered to vote in the past elections to say, okay, we'll give this guy a shot. There's some circumstantial evidence for this this conclusion, right? Everybody says that the polls missed these voters, that the polling didn't get them. And here's how the pollsters determine who is likely to vote. They use what's known as a likely voter screen. This varies from pollster to pollster, but most of them pose a series of questions like, do you know where your polling place is? Did you vote in 2012? Et cetera, to decide who are the likely voters. So if these were mostly people who voted for Obama in 2012 and then switched to Trump for this year, then they would be counted in the polls. They would know where their polling place is. They would say that they voted last time. And those who didn't vote in recent elections would not. And the other thing that we know is that partisanship, as we've become more polarized, partisanship has become more entrenched and stable, right? Yes, there are lots of people who say that they're independents, but if you'll remember, regular listeners know, remember a few months ago we had on Michigan State University political scientist Corwin Schmidt, and he said that, yeah, the people who call themselves independents for the most part are closet partisans, and there are very few people who are really, really swing voters who can see themselves voting for a candidate from either party. So, you know, the idea that Trump got all these Democrats rather than Republican-leaning voters to the polls is just, it runs counter to what we know about partisanship being pretty stable. And also, nobody assumes that Trump's gains among, say, Latinos or African Americans mark a permanent realignment or are something that we have to worry about in the future. And I don't see any reason to believe that that's true for these white working class Democrats. And the other thing is that, you know, there are big regional differences, but in nationwide, if you look at it nationwide, Democrats have long struggled to win white working class voters, right? That's not new. That's been true for decades and decades. And what was new in 2016 was a massive education gap opening up among voters of all colors and all races and creeds and religions. In 2012, there was no difference, virtually no difference. There were a few points between college grads and non-college grads. And that's typically the way it is. There's not much difference. But this year, those without a college degree favored Trump by 8 points, and those with a college degree favored Clinton by 9 points. So there was this 17-point education gap, and that was the biggest one that they've ever seen. I think they started in asking about your education and exit polls in like 1980. So for 36 years or something like that, they've never seen this kind of education gap. So we could be calling it a white working class problem or an education problem or a low income problem. It's the choice to focus on this group of white working class Democrats is really risky. And if you try to court them, you would risk alienating the fastest growing groups within the Democratic coalition, right? Non-college educated whites are actually a demographic that's in decline. College graduation rates are rising. The electorate is becoming more diverse. And while they may have broken heavily for Trump, their overall share of the electorate were down. So this is the thing. Democrats should focus on a progressive economic agenda, I think, both because it's good policy in this new gilded age and because there's evidence that it does spur enthusiasm among their entire coalition, including with non-college whites. So watch out for the conventional wisdom. Sometimes it can lead you astray. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Here's Cultura Profética with a cover of Bob Marley's classic.
Get up, stand up.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. This is Joshua Holland. I'm doing my post-mortem on this 2016 election. So one of the saddest stories that I read since Donald Trump's election last week was in the New York Times. They profiled workers at the Carrier factory in Indianapolis. They're going to lose their jobs when the plant is relocated to Mexico. Trump mentioned this plant again and again and again during the course of the campaign. It was kind of like symbolic of how our stupid leaders had sold out American workers to global elites or whatever. And he said on the stump, and this is a quote, "I'll get a call from the head of Carrier and he'll say, 'Mr. President, we've decided to stay in the United States. That's what's going to happen 100%, right? And here's what's so sad. A lot of these Carrier workers believed him. They believed him. A lot of them pinned their hopes for the future on Trump's election. They stayed up late into the night last Tuesday, or the Tuesday before last, waiting on pins and needles for the results. And of course, Carrier hasn't reconsidered its plans. It's moving the plant to Monterrey. Hedge funds are pushing for the move. In a statement issued a few days after the election, the Carrier officials made it clear that they are not going to change their plans. And what I think that we're going to see is just an epic case of buyer's remorse by the people who supported Trump. This was not the only promise that he made that he couldn't deliver, right? Anyone with even the most rudimentary understanding of how America's government works knew that all that stuff Trump was saying was stuff he wouldn't be able to do, right? He's not going to make coal cheaper than natural gas and bring back a bunch of mining jobs. You know, it's possible that he can negotiate some minor riders for NAFTA, but he's not going to cancel NAFTA. And whatever he negotiates is going to be guided by the same corporate lobbyists who basically wrote it in the first place. They're not going to bring back jobs that have been sent overseas. There's not going to be a 35% tariff on imports from Mexico or China. We're not going to pull out of NATO. Right. Congress isn't going to give him $600 billion to round up and deport 11 million undocumented immigrants. Right. That would, by the way, that would cost, according to one study, that would cost the economy $1.6 trillion in output. And Trump's already walked back that really central promise of his campaign. He kind of hinted that he might even consider what his supporters scream about all the time, amnesty. You might even consider an amnesty. And a lot of the people, these right, alt-right types, they believed him. They believed all of this stuff. And immediately after being elected, the candidate who kind of bashed the establishment during the entire campaign, the guy who promised to drain the swamp, what did he do? He immediately surrounded himself with, like, party hacks and lobbyists. So, you know, he put RNC chair Reince Priebus, who is, I guess, the most prominent face of the establishment, in as his head of staff. He is surrounding himself with the people who sold us on the Iraq War, even though he called that stupid, and said that we shouldn't trust those people. Those are his national security advisors. And Politico's Ben White reported, and I'll quote this. He said, "A populist candidate who railed against shady financial interests on Wall Street on the campaign trail is now putting together an administration that looks like an investment banker's dream," right? So you have those Trump voters. I mentioned in the last segment, the group that kind of swung most dramatically, non-college educated, low-income people, are going to face a serious bait and switch. The GOP Congress they will give him his tax cuts, that's for sure. But an analysis this week showed that it pays for huge cuts for those at the top by eliminating like family credits, family tax credits, stuff for single parent households are going to get screwed. And, you know, and anyway, federal taxes are progressive, local and state taxes are regressive. So when you cut federal funding, the states make up for it. And so a lot of these people are going to see their taxes actually go up, all if you can include all of their taxes, right? In the meantime, he's going to do a lot to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. There's questions about exactly what he's going to do, but he's definitely going to take health insurance away from a lot of people. They're going to lose food stamps and Head Start slots. If Paul Ryan gets his way and block grants Medicaid and privatizes Medicare, their economic insecurity, which we've heard about throughout this campaign, is going to rise significantly. We can forget about Obama's overtime rule, which would have given 12.5 million people a raise, according to the Economic Policy Institute. And if they don't kill it entirely, at least they're going to hobble the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which reined in the kind of predatory lending schemes that screw over the working poor. They'll certainly lose access to reproductive health care. It's going to be a death by a thousand cuts, right? And again, the pain is going to be focused intensely on these Trump supporters. They're going to be bearing the brunt of what is, you know, going to be basically standard issue Republican governments, but in the extreme, because they hold all three branches of government and the Supreme Court. Now, it's possible, and maybe it's even likely, that Trump supporters will give him a pass on the policy reversals, right? We know there was a book by UC Berkeley political scientist Gabriel Lenz called Follow the Leader, and he argued that most voters choose a candidate and then kind of work backwards to justify their support for that candidate's policies. It works backwards. As long as the candidate is seen as being kind of broadly successful, Trump will certainly claim to be successful, and the right-wing media will report that he's being successful. So if you live in that bubble, you will likely, even if he's an awful president, or it's a sure thing that he's going to be an awful president, even when he is an awful president, a lot of those people are going to think that he's doing a good job. And of course, they'll still have immigrants and the undeserving poor to scapegoat. But here's the thing. Trump's promises went really that well beyond proposals for this or that policy. The policy proposals were only tangential to his meta promise, right? Which was not only to kind of clean up Washington, but something even more impossible, right? He promised them that he could turn the clock back and just undo decades of demographic and social change. And whatever else he might achieve, that's not going to happen. Donald Trump isn't going to make this country less diverse. He's not going to make college campuses less politically correct or whatever. He's not going to return gender relations to the 1960s or 70s or whatever. He will not make white Christians the majority group in this country again. And, you know, that they wanted him to do something that is beyond impossible. And they're going to face the same kind of realization that a lot of progressives did when Barack Obama didn't come into Washington and like end racism or partisanship in Congress. We don't just elect a president. We elect like 2,500 members of one political coalition or the other to policymaking positions across this huge, sprawling government. And anyone who pins their hopes on an individual savior, like those carrier workers in Indiana or Breitbart readers, is guaranteed to be disappointed. In this case, the disappointment is going to be more profound because he promised more and because his party will likely have unified control of government for his entire first term, and they won't be able to blame the Democrats on it. So I think a question is, how will Trump's energized fans ultimately react to his failures to enact his agenda, to his failures to follow through, deliver on his promises? The best case scenario is that they, I guess, become more disillusioned and just sit out 2020. The worst case scenario is that they'll become more reactionary and more hardened and more likely to lash out at those whom they perceive to be the other. And on that happy note, we are about out of time. I want to thank everybody for tuning in this week. Stay strong, get organized. I also want to thank Digby and Crooks and Liars for letting me park my show at their place. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or wherever else you find it. You can also send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Take care of yourselves. Have a good week. We'll be back next week with a regular show.